the healthcare industry will continue to be one of the largest employers of college graduates. More jobs are expected to be with nursing than any other occupation. Are you ready to make a difference in the world? Are you looking for an education and career that has advancement? Right now, there is a high demand for nurses, both male and female. Breaking into the nursing career means getting an education. Henry Ford Community College offers an associate's degree in the nursing program. All graduates can acquire full-time employment upon passing the licensing examination for registered nurses. For more information, please call 313-845-6300. Once again, that's 313-845-6300. Or look us up on the web at hfcc.edu. Henry Ford Community College. The right education, right now.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as worldwide scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. On September 28, 2013, the scientific community lost a great contributor. At the same time, Michigan MUFON lost a good friend. William C. Levengood, affectionately known as Lefty, passed away at the age of 88 near his Grass Lake, Michigan home and laboratory. Listeners of this show may recall his name being mentioned before in connection with crop formations and bovine excisions, commonly referred to as cattle mutilations. His method for determining the authenticity of crop formations have become the standard for seriologists worldwide. He discovered many telltale signs in the plants and soil samples of genuine crop formations to distinguish them from man-made formations. He was the first to notice bovine hemoglobin at the site of cattle mutilations in the pasture, where such could only be accomplished in a laboratory with chemicals, a centrifuge, and strict temperature control. Like most open-minded scientists, he covertly accepted the UFO reality. However, for most of his career, he would only allude to the anomalous origins of the phenomenon in official scientific papers, out of the fear of professional ridicule. Then in 2002, he wrote a report. For the first time, he publicly alludes to the extraterrestrial intervention as a possible solution. And Dr. W.C. Levengood's contribution to science has, in his many patented inventions and books, will long outlive his physical shell. He was a good man and a better friend, who will be sorely missed by all who had the great fortune to have known him. And one of Dr. Levengood's close friends and laboratory assistants was Marilyn Rubin, who was a guest on this show in September of 2010. And Marilyn is the webmaster for the largest site on the web that deals with the alien abduction experience. That's www.abduct.com. Abduct.com. And I thought it would be apropos to have her back to discuss not only her work, but that of Dr. Levengood's. So, without further ado, welcome to the show, Marilyn.
Hi, David. Thank you for inviting me. I'm very glad to be on your program.
Well, thank you. It's good to have you back. I'm sorry that we have to have you on these under these circumstances, though.
Yes, it really is sad. As you said, the world lost a great scientist when Lefty passed away.
Really, I'm afraid. So, well, you knew the man better than most, so tell us what kind of a man Levengood was.
Lefty, if I can call him Lefty.
Please do.
Was a very, very dedicated scientist. You know, a lot of times people talk about, oh, when I retire, I'm going to travel, and I'm going to go to Europe, I'm going to go to South America, I'm going to get a motorcycle, do all these other things.
Mm-hmm.
In Lefty's case, there was never a line drawn between his career and his retirement.
Did he ever retire?
He worked in his lab 7 days a week, 12, 14 hours a day.
Sure.
He had tests running constantly. He would get up at 2 a.m. in the morning, check the test results, and then he would be back up again at 6 a.m. in the lab, checking the test results, writing them down, taking measurements, and then just all through the day. He was very dedicated.
Yeah. I remember he told me that he went to bed at 8 o'clock in the evening and got up at 2:30 in the morning.
That's correct.
And I said, what's that all about? And he says, it's a long story. So I never did find out that story, but whatever. that was his ritual, and that was great.
Yeah.
Get up and feed his horse.
Well, yes, part of it was to check on the horses at his wife's request or her insistence.
All right.
So the horses were always fine.
Well,
but
sure.
He checked on them, and then he would check on the lab and check the test results.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his lifestyle.
So he never really did retire until he could not do it anymore, right?
Correct. Right up until the very end, he was still working on his experiments and recording his data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, Levengood holds a patent with Dr. John Getty for a device involving electric charge pulses in living organisms. You were instrumental in proving its effectiveness. Tell us about that.
Well, there were some of us that were fortunate enough to be tested on it, and what he was able to prove with this machine is that it could measure the electrical impulse that the individual could generate. And the test subjects, like myself, we would stand there, we held the two aluminum rods, one in each hand, and we would go into quick meditation or whatever we required to feel ourselves building our mental energy.
Mm-hmm.
And then his machine, a CDP machine, would record the energy spikes and the increases. And so he was able to take measurements from those.
Okay, so how was he able to know exactly, how do I put this? What you were thinking, what your emotions were. Did he have you think of something sad and then something that made you happy, and then measure that, or what's the deal with that?
Well, what he would do is he would ask me, he would see the spike, and he would say, okay, 10 seconds into this, the graph suddenly spiked. What were you thinking?
So
our goal was to make sure we were keeping track of what we were thinking about and what visualizations we were using to cause the energy level to increase or decrease.
Hmm. So were you able to find out, was he able to find out, ascertain, in other words, did it spike when you were happy and go down when you're sad, or what? According to what you were thinking?
Yes. He saw some variations, and he was able to detect patterns in the graphing pattern, if I can call it that.
Mm.
And there were some people that would go in the lab, and he would test them, and then he would finish the test. He would look at the chart, and he would say, did you by any chance have a back injury a long time ago? And the person would always say, well, yes, I did. You know, I was in this accident or that accident, and my back has been messed up ever since.
Mm.
And that was always interesting, because then he would show us where the graph deviated.
Hmm.
Because it would always do some particular thing on the chart.
All right.
So that's why he and Dr. Getty were so intrigued with using this for medical purposes, because it was a matter of measuring the different spikes to determine, you know, what kind of pain the patient was in.
All right. Well, he was able to prove the effectiveness of this device to the U.S. Patent Office. Was he able to, when I say they, I mean Levengood and Getty, were they ever able to prove this to doctors, hospitals, and have them implemented in hospitals, for example?
No, unfortunately, it didn't get that far. Part of that, I think, was because Dr. Getty unfortunately passed away at a younger age, and it just didn't get the medical community support that it needed.
I see. Was Dr. Getty a physician?
Yes, he was trained over in England, and he came to the United States, I think, back in the 1980s.
Okay. Hmm. So you have a biophysicist and a physician.
An MD.
An MD get together, and they could do some damage. Well, it seems like that device is, you know, still around. And
yes, it's still around.
Yeah. It should be out there, you know what I'm saying?
Out there. Yes, I agree. It needs somebody in the medical community working with another scientist to probably push the thing forward.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't a cure-all. It just detected this. Is that correct?
Right. It was a diagnostic tool.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Okay. There was an experiment also with Joyce Hagelthorne. Many of our listeners wouldn't remember Joyce Hagelthorne, but she had a show of exploring the psyche and on another radio station. And she was a good friend of ours and a MUFON, MUFON member. Do you remember the story of her?
Yes. One of the things Lefty wanted to prove using his CDP machine was that people could influence the machine from a distance.
Mm-hmm.
So he and Joyce set up that at some time during the day, she would not tell him when, she would begin sending her energy to the machine from her home, which was about an hour and a half away.
Hour and a half drive.
And so she did. And his machine, his CDP machine, did record a spike that they correlated to when she began concentrating to build up her energy for the machine to detect.
Mm-hmm.
And then it dropped off because she fell asleep. And then when she woke up, she started up again trying to focus her energy and build it again and send it to his machine. And his machine also recorded that.
Recorded the fact that she, it was nil. In other words, it wasn't spiking at all, right?
Correct, when she was asleep.
So
and then when she woke up and remembered she had dropped the ball and had to get back on the experiment, then it began spiking again on his machine.
Wow.
So while he's watching this pattern being graphed on his machine, not knowing why it suddenly went nil for a while, then he found out afterwards.
So really, this machine detected psychic abilities.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, I think it proves the ability of the mind to influence physical objects.
Yeah. Well, his deal was energy.
Yes.
And we are all energy, and that energy has a connectivity, obviously, he proved with his machine, a connectivity that defies the miles, right?
Yes, absolutely.
You know, I remember saying to him, you know, he was not a very religious man. But,
True, but spiritual.
And he said that the energy that's in the physical body had the seed of consciousness in it, and it survived physical death. And I asked him, I said, do you believe there's a source of this energy? And he said, yes. So I said, doesn't that sound like the human soul and a spiritual creator? And he thought a moment, and he said, no.
That's funny.
So, you know, he wouldn't admit to a God or a spiritual creator. He wouldn't admit to the human soul, but it was, you know, we all have this energy that has the seed of consciousness that survives physical death, and it's all connected from a source. Other than that, there's no religion involved. So, hey, however you want to look at it, you know.
that's why he steered away from religion. He just didn't want to be labeled. But you're right. What you are describing is actually very spiritual when you start talking about consciousness surviving after death and the soul.
Right. Yeah.
And he definitely believed that. So call it what you will, but it sounds spiritual to me.
Yeah, you can put any name tag on it you want. That's what it is.
Yeah, but, exactly.
But that was Lefty. Kind of love him.
Yeah, well, for sure.
Yeah. What about the crop formations? What was your, in cattle mutilations, what was your involvement in that?
Well, I found that absolutely fascinating. There's a lot of intrigue about crop formations. He always resented it when reporters would refer to it as crop circles. He would say to us, the rest of us, they're not always circles. They're different shapes.
Right.
You know, and he was right. They weren't just circles. There were some interesting things because these circles or crop formations started appearing mostly over in England and not so much anywhere else in the world. And I asked him about that one time. I said, why does England have all of these incredible formations that go on? You know, they're multiple sizes of football fields and they're very beautiful. And I said, why don't we have those happening, you know, in Michigan? And he said, the weather over in England is different than it is over here.
Oh, really?
And one of the things I learned from him and Dr. Getty is that over in England, they don't have the thunder and lightning storms like we have them here in the States. And one of Lefty's speculations was maybe that somehow enables crop formations to be formed.
The lack of lightning.
Because of the energy in the atmosphere is different.
Well, they certainly have a lot of rain in London and England, I mean.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Boy, I was there once and, Well, I was in Germany for 18 months, and I'll tell you what, it's very, very humid and a lot of rain, a lot of snow. And then I guess I was very fortunate when I, my wife and I went on a cruise to, you know, North Atlantic cruise, and stopped in London. And we had a beautiful day, and it started to get cloudy, and by next day it was pouring down rain. But we had one good day out of it. And, of course, I caught a cold out of the deal, but but that's another story. I digress.
Yeah. but that's the weather. It is different than what we have here.
Right.
And we don't know. Maybe there's a correlation. I mean, there must be something.
So are you saying the lack of lightning strikes?
That was just speculation. Between my conversations with him and having spoken with him and Dr. Getty about the differences in the weather, it was like, well, this is different, but we don't know what the cause is or what the correlation is.
Yeah, but now we're having crop formations in America.
Yeah,
all
we
over
are.
The world. All
we're slowly
the world.
Catching up.
And you know, people say, oh, that's just some guy out there with a board and a rope.
Yeah.
But between you and Lefty, if you figured out that wasn't just a, well, not in all cases, was it?
No, the crop circles that people make with a board and a rope are very, very obvious. You can take anyone who has never been familiar with crop formations, show them a real crop formation, and then show them a crop circle made with a board, and immediately the differences are very, very apparent. There is no fooling anybody. The board bends the stalks over, and it cracks them, so they split.
Right.
In a real crop formation, the stalks are bent over at the same 90-degree angle, but they don't crack. The node enlarges there at that point and will have a tiny hole in it, which Lefty has explained, that is where the steam escaped because these stalks have been heated on the outside to over 1,000 degrees. But, so visually, they're just different.
And it's microwave energy, is that?
Yes.
microwave energy.
So they do physically look different to the person looking at them.
Yeah.
And also anything made with a board is rather, I have seen ones made with boards and they're very sloppy. As you can imagine, tromping anything down, it's not a neat pattern. The real crop formations are fascinating because the layers of wheat, for instance, will be intertwined. It'll be like a basket weave.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at them, you go, oh my gosh, this thing is perfectly woven. One layer on top of another, and they're all laying down. The stalks are still alive.
Hmm.
Nothing is cracked or damaged.
Yeah.
It's just mind-boggling.
And how would someone with a board and a rope, with any kind of device like that, be able to make that checkerboard weave design?
I don't think they could.
I don't know. Boy, that would take a while, wouldn't it?
Yeah, sure. And I think they'd have to have more than one board.
Yeah.
And a lot of hands, and I don't think it would really be feasible.
I don't either. I have to take a moment just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves at Henry Ford Community College in Dearborn, Michigan. And I am David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone, and we're speaking with researcher Marilyn Rubin. And we're talking about, presently, Dr. W.C. Levengood, who passed away in September, unfortunately, after 88 years of life and contribution to the scientific world, and to the UFO phenomenon as well. What other experiments were you involved in with him other than, the cattle mutilations. We didn't touch on that. Did you have
the cattle mutilations, that was a fascinating thing because people would contact me through the website. They would report seeing their cattle lifted up in the air, flown away, or lifted high up, and a couple hours later they would find the cattle dropped from a height of maybe 200 or 300 feet. One of their big issues was, each of these animals is worth thousands of dollars. And aside from the cruelty to the animal, it was a loss to their business.
Yeah.
And they could not understand why or who would be abducting their cattle, what they were doing with them, and inflicting these just awful things onto the cattle.
When you say that they witnessed the cattle being lifted in the air, did they see the craft or whatever it was that was lifting them?
Yes, they said it was like a UFO around disk.
Wow. Were they ever able to get pictures?
I think a couple people did get pictures. I don't happen to have any.
Mm. I saw a picture of a disk-shaped UFO lifting a cow in the field.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it was a hoax picture or not. I'm not a photo analyst, but it looked pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm. But, yes, I think I know which picture you're referring to. Yes, that is quite an impressive picture.
Yeah.
Kind of a sobering thought to see a picture like that.
Really? Well, they have, pictures aside, they have found cattle in the trees.
Yep, they have.
And I've never heard of a cow climbing a tree before.
No, I don't think they have the ability.
I don't think so.
Yeah, it's been strange.
Yeah. But
so the question there is, why or who is doing this to the cattle? Is this the military? Is this UFO related? I tend to think it's probably more UFO related.
Yeah, but the military could go out and buy a cow.
Right.
Now, why would they want to mess around? And they want to keep this the lid on this UFO subject. They just want the UFO subject to go away. Why would they do something that would stimulate UFO speculation? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. I don't think they would want to any more than UFOs want to draw attention to themselves. So you have each group wanting no humans to know about UFOs. The military doesn't want anyone to know, and the UFOs are trying to be as secretive as they can, but it's not working.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be working. No. In fact, Lefty told me once that he had his own UFO sighting several years ago. Did he ever tell you about that?
Oh, was that the one involving his porch?
Yeah, he was on his porch and so on, early in the morning.
Yeah, yeah, and he spotted it. I think that was good that he saw that.
Yeah?
I think it kind of firmed things up in his own mind, because up to that point, it was all the rest of us telling him our stories that we had heard from others,
right,
or things that we ourselves had seen.
Right.
So it was nice he had his own experience.
Right. And then there was the thing, now that you mention his porch, I should have looked that up, because I know I have it in my computer. Pictures of his porch that were damaged on one side, just the oddest thing. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that was some unexplained damage that occurred during the night to his porch, and it wasn't anything that could be logically explained.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the metal railing was twisted up in such a way.
Right.
So I think his thought was it must have something to do with microwave energy.
Mm-hmm.
But he said it definitely was not caused by anything normal that would happen.
Right.
And he did not have an explanation for it.
Yeah, I've seen the pictures. I didn't see it personally, but he took pictures. And as a wrought iron railing was just twisted like a pretzel.
Yeah.
And he knew that it was, you know, perfectly all right the night before, but he heard something.
And there were no storms.
No.
To explain it or to try to pin it on.
Right. But he heard some kind of noise in the middle of the night and went out and investigated, but it was too dark to see anything. Couldn't find anything. He went back to bed, and then when it was daylight, he saw his deck was torn apart and his railing was twisted into a pretzel.
Yeah, and the other interesting thing is this porch railing was on the second floor.
Yeah.
So it's not like anybody could say, well, it must have been the wild animals coming out of the woods or something like that.
Very strong wild animals.
Yeah, for sure.
But, you know, the skeptic will assign such an explanation if they really don't want to believe anything, you know, because what's the alternative, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. They'll come up with some excuse.
Right, and they'll stick to it, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, tell us about your website, Marilyn.
Well, my website is Alien Abduction Experience and Research, www.abduct.com. World's largest website on alien abductions. It was the first website in the world to have a message board where people could start communicating with each other about, hey, this happened to me. Has it happened to you? And people got to know each other through the message board and find out that other people around the world were having similar experiences.
All right. That's kind of like the alien abduction experience itself, where the Hills, Betty and Barney Hill, their story came out, and psychiatrists around the world started comparing notes and saying, well, you know, I've had other people come to me with that kind of psychosis, those kind of dreams, and they're very similar. And then they started realizing there wasn't psychosis, those weren't dreams. These things were actually happening to people. So.
Yeah, that's true. And it was a problem, or it still is a problem for the psychological community, because they have what they call the DSM manual, which is their diagnostic manual, and they assign numbers to different psychoses or whatever they diagnose the patient's ailment as. And there is nothing in the DSM manual that allows for alien abduction.
So they just throw it out?
They throw it out.
Yeah.
So for insurance purposes, there's no billing the insurance company for assisting anyone who's having post-traumatic stress from having had an abduction experience.
Right. Yeah, I had a psychiatrist on my show quite a while ago, and he said the exact same thing. You can't put that tag on it because, you know, they only go by a number, and there is no number for alien abduction.
Yeah.
So you'd have to put it under psychosis or whatever, and then the person's labeled. Well, Doc, yeah. you put down here the guy was psychotic, right? So how could that possibly exist? Well, so
it's not.
Go ahead.
It's not an accurate label, and it's unfortunate
right. That
there is not more of an open mind in the psychological field.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there are psychiatrists and psychologists who will work with abductees covertly.
Now, true.
Do you know any of these?
Yes, I've met some of them. Mm-hmm. There are probably, in Michigan, two or three in southern Michigan.
Okay.
Three that I've heard of, and I will not say their names.
No.
But they do their work covertly. They do not want to run up a flag that they work with abductees because they do not want to be ridiculed by their peers.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I do understand that, but I am grateful that at least there are some of them willing to work with abductees in the stress that they go through.
All right. Well, it was the same reason that Lefty wouldn't come out and say, yeah, UFOs are real.
True.
My sister and I went out to his laboratory one time, and she says to him, Doctor, are these UFOs real? He just leaned back and said, well, of course they're real. Like, you know, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, like, why are you asking him that question?
Yeah, of course they're real. He said. But he would never say so publicly until, like I say, in 2002, he came out with this this report, and he tagged them UFOs.
I asked him about that at the time, and he said, Marilyn, I'm at that age now where, you know what, it doesn't matter what they say. This is what I'm going to tell them.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
might as well.
I was glad he did that.
Yes, yeah. While he
and
was...
he took that position then for all the rest of the things he wrote, which was he was going to say it the way it was.
Yeah.
And if the professional community didn't like it, he wasn't going to worry about it.
No. No, he paid his dues.
Yep.
Yeah. And did he ever take any flack from the mainstream scientific community for that? Do you know?
He was always subject to getting some kind of flack or comments, but he wasn't too worried about it, if that's what you're getting at.
No, but I mean, did any of his colleagues come back and say, wait a minute, what do you mean UFO? What do you mean flying saucer or you know, anomalous disc. What are you talking about?
The ones who would have, he would have absolutely ignored.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was of the mind that he didn't care if they believed it or not.
Right.
In his mind, it was real, and that was the end of the subject.
Right. Especially after his own sighting.
Yeah, and that's why I was very glad that happened, because that really firmed it up in his own mind.
Right, right. Yeah, you can believe the testimony of, I would say there are skeptics, debunkers, believers, and witnesses.
Yeah.
And the strongest evidence you can have is if you are a witness.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That's true, because at that point you suddenly realize that whatever it is you were reading or hearing about from other people, you realize, wow, this is really real, and I'm seeing it now for myself.
Yeah, yeah. Then there are a lot of skeptics. I know I've been a UFO investigator for a number of years, and I hear a lot of times people say, you know, I didn't believe this. I was a total skeptic until that night, that fateful evening. And now I believe. Well, yeah, seeing is believing. So,
and skeptics make the best believers, because once they have seen it or experienced it for themselves, they are suddenly the great spokespersons
Right.
For whatever it is, the subject, they suddenly believe.
Right. But a lot of them will just not come forward with the information because they have been the ridiculer for so long, they do not want to be subjected to that, right?
No, definitely true. Yeah.
So it's a catch-22 situation. But we find that the more people come forward, the more people will come forward.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. So. And our technology is making that possible. You know, how often on the news now or YouTube do you hear about somebody's got another video of a UFO or something like that? I mean, it's now becoming much more commonplace than it was, say, 10 years ago.
Yeah. Of course, the monker is going to say, well, gee, I can do that on my paint shop or Photoshop, you know.
Then I say to them, go ahead and try it.
Yeah, do it. Let's see it.
Yeah.
Let's see it.
Under high magnification, you can tell if a photo's been altered by the pixels.
That's certainly.
So it's.
You can tell if it's been overlapped. You can tell if it's.
Yep.
You know, if there's a background that a disc-shaped object has been put over that picture, you know, layered over it. I'm not, like I say, I'm not a photo analyst, but I know how you can do it, you know?
Right.
I don't know how to do it.
And if you saw it magnified, you would recognize that part of the picture as being, hey, this is not realistic here.
Right, right.
Something's been changed. This background doesn't match the rest of the background.
And there's a ton of them on YouTube, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes I'll go in there. I'll see a couple of very convincing shots of videos and pictures. And then some nutcase will put some silly-looking guy in there with an alien suit.
Yeah, a little bit of humor, I guess.
Yeah, okay. But don't waste my time with it, you know. I'm serious about this. Let's get serious, but... Anyway,
but they'll do it.
Yeah. I'm going to take one more break to remind our listeners, then we won't be interrupted again, you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with researcher Marilyn Rubin, and she is the webmaster for Abduct.com. And Marilyn, you've had some experiences yourself.
Oh yes, quite a few.
When did this start?
I think my stuff for myself started probably as a kid. Mm-hmm. One of the back in the years ago, they used to have advertisements in the ladies' magazines of light bulbs that the ladies could buy. And before I could talk, my mother would sit there with her sisters, and they would be looking at Ladies' Home Journal and these other women's magazines. And I would come along, still, you know, just at the age of 1 year old, and this is the story they told me over the years, which is why I remember it. I would get excited, come up to them looking at the magazine, and I would start tapping the GE light bulbs in the advertisements.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought, oh, how cute. Marilyn must love light bulbs. I look back on that now and I laugh and I think, the shape of a light bulb kind of is just like an alien head. I wonder if there's a connection.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. So what happened to you to convince you?
That was probably my first experience. I was probably seeing something in my bedroom at night, didn't have the words for it, but recognized the shape of the alien head and got excited in a happy way when I saw it in the magazines.
Yeah. But then I remember you telling a story about you and a friend, I believe it was, who went to some strange house as a child.
Yeah, when I was about 5 years old, myself and about five friends were out in the neighborhood walking around, and it was a late afternoon. It was a little on the cool side, so it might have either been early spring or early fall. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, where there had never been a house, there was a house. So, of course, you know, we kids, being 5 and 6 years old, we were all very curious. What is this house that was never there before? So we decided to go up the sidewalk, and we knocked on the door, and all of this is totally out of character for us because, you know, kids are always told, you know, don't knock on strangers' doors, you know, don't talk to strangers and so forth. But there we were, just very boldly knocking on this front door that was answered by what we assumed would be a mom and a dad. And they let us in the house, and the mother asked me to go downstairs with her, so I went with her. And I could hear my friends upstairs for a little while, and then I could hear them go out the front door. So it was just me alone in the house with this woman that I thought was just the mother of the house. And all of this is totally out of character for me, but I sat there until 9 p.m. that night, and she kept showing me things. It was like magic. She would make things appear and disappear, and she was explaining to me all these things about the cosmos and the universe, and I was just totally, totally enthralled. And around 7:30, I told her, you know, I really have to go home. You know, I've already missed my dinner, blah, blah, blah.
Hmm.
And she said, no, don't worry. It'll be all right with your mother, which, of course, that was not true at all.
I'm sure.
But anyway, 9 o'clock's totally dark out. So I go back home scared to death because, you know, when you're a little kid walking down the street late at night, you know, the bushes are rustling, the trees are rustling. And by the time I got home, I got a terrible spanking and my parents are screaming at me, we thought you were abducted. Or actually, they said, we thought you were kidnapped, but they didn't know it was more like an abduction.
Same thing.
But they sent me to bed without my dinner, and then they wanted to know where was I and what did I do, and I refused to tell them.
Hmm.
And it wasn't until I was an adult that I told them, you know, gee, it's too bad I didn't say more about what happened, because over the years I have forgotten the details.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe they
part of what historians tell us is that we can preserve history by talking about it. And because I didn't tell anybody what happened back then, I actually lost a lot of the details.
Yeah. Hmm. But
so,
not,
anyway, I never asked my little friends about the house. The house was not there the next day, which I thought was a little odd. But, you know, when you're that young, you're more accepting of strange things that happen in your neighborhood.
Yeah.
But those are all common scenarios I've heard from others who had their experiences with other kids. They don't talk to each other. They've already been told by the aliens, you will not share the story. You will not talk about it. You will not ask your friends about it. But you don't remember that. But those are the instructions you're given, and that's the game plan you follow.
Wow.
So that was the game plan I followed, and I never talked about that experience until I was an adult.
Can you remember what this couple looked like?
No, unfortunately, I don't. Obviously, it must have been more human-like because it did not scare any of us.
Right.
And we were somehow convinced that this was a mom and a dad and that these were new people in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to have to assume that there were no light bulb heads, no big alien eyes, nothing like that. They would have had to look convincingly human.
But because of the light bulb thing, did you have experience with the small grays or tall grays?
I don't remember any. I just remember that I got excited about the light bulbs in the magazines. I recognized them.
Ah. You recognize,
and yet light bulbs were not something that kids played with. I mean, it wasn't a toy.
Right, right.
It wasn't a normal thing that, you know, I at a young age, you know, would get excited about.
Mm-hmm. But that's the only explanation you can come up with, huh?
Yeah, as an adult looking back, I mean, if it had been anything else in the magazine, I probably could have explained it differently, but light bulbs are just light bulbs, you know, for lamps.
Right,
they have
right,
one
right.
shape, and it's the alien head shape.
Right. Not anymore, though, huh?
No, not anymore. They're all different now.
Yeah, there'll be the squiggly head aliens, right?
Yeah, the squiggly head. There you go. Yeah.
So tell us about some of the other people that you, without mentioning any names, of course, people confide in you their abduction experiences. What are some of them that stand out in your, a couple of them that stand out in your mind?
Well, there have been a lot of stories that I've heard of. Some of the common factors that come out in the stories are really, really interesting.
Such as?
People will sometimes wake up in their beds at night and they look up at the ceiling and they will see a swirling black light. And it's like the ceiling opens up into another universe. Mm. And they feel themselves being pulled up through the ceiling and they go and they're gone. and then they're in that other world. Hmm. And then they come back through the ceiling or through a side bedroom window or something like that.
Hmm.
I've heard stories of people that were abducted, in their PJs. And in the morning, they're brought back. And then in the morning when they wake up, they realize they're either not wearing their own pajamas or their pajamas are inside out.
Hmm.
There have been a couple situations where people came back and they found their PJs folded up on the bed, just weird things like that.
Hmm. Well, now that type of thing, not wearing your pajamas folded up on the bed, that can be explained. You could have done that in your sleep. But one story I heard was this one woman claimed to have been abducted and woke up with some Japanese pajamas on. With Japanese words, pajamas she didn't own, from Japan.
Yes.
And
yeah, that's strange. That just shows that abductions are worldwide,
Shows
when
that
they fly around and pick up people, they pick up people from all over.
Shows that the aliens are not very cautious either. They put the
clothes on. They don't worry about who gets what clothing, I guess. Well, if you've got a top and a bottom, be grateful.
Yeah.
But there have been similar stories of people who have been abducted out of their cars.
Oh, yeah.
In the back seat. One of the things that will precipitate something like that is you'll hear stories from adults, and they'll say, well, when they were a kid, this weird thing happened. They were in the back seat of the family car, and another car came up to them, and there was this huge flash of light, and after that, they were abducted. And as growing up as adults, they would say, well, that flash of light must be somebody driving by taking my picture. But, when you think about it, does that make any sense? Do people normally drive up and down the street, taking flash pictures of people in other cars?
Yeah, right.
But these people, after they do a little bit of regression, or they think about it, or they have dreams, they realize that was the start of an abduction experience.
Right. All right. And then where does it go from there? I mean, how are they able to accept that and into their, acclimate that into their lives, their normal lives, once they find out through hypnosis?
It's really hard. I always caution people about jumping into hypnosis. I think it's a wonderful tool. I think people need to be fully, fully aware that once they open that door, they are going to be experiencing emotions that they never had an opportunity before to experience. And it's going to hit them really hard.
And
it's going to tear them apart. And they'll probably go through about a 6-month period of absolute trauma. They'll be terrified of sleeping, terrified of being in bed, terrified of being alone, terrified of walking at night or going out in the car to a place they've never been. It's just all the fears that have been buried suddenly are let loose. And I said to them, and I've always encouraged them, go ahead with hypnosis, but just remember, you're going to need a good support network, somebody here that's going to help you.
Yeah.
So that you can get through this trauma.
And what is...
And then once they get through the trauma, they're okay. But that 6 months is pretty rough.
So what is said to them or done with them during that 6 months to convince them, hey, you know what, even though this happened, you're back here, you're going to work, it hasn't been happening lately, whatever. What is done to convince them?
I think what happens to the people is when they were abducted previously, they never had a chance to experience the normal emotions that would go with an abduction. For instance, if you're driving down your car and you're suddenly abducted out of your car, if you were allowed to remain conscious, you would be absolutely terrified. What is happening to me? Why am I on the interstate and I'm suddenly being sucked up out of my car?
Hmm.
Who are these individuals that are looking at me? Why are they poking me? What are they doing to me? Why aren't they still in my car? I mean, you would just be flooded with all kinds of questions like that.
And fears.
But the average abductee has never had that opportunity to let those flood of memories come through and those questions and the absolute terror.
Mm.
So once they start the hypnosis, they are going to experience all of those feelings that never had an opportunity before to be released.
Right. Maybe that's why I don't want to get hypnotized.
Yeah, it's you know, people may joke, you know, but it's a door. Once you open it,
yeah,
you're probably not going to be able to close it.
Ignorance is bliss, huh?
Yeah, but then, you know, curiosity killed the cat, too.
Yeah,
so, you
that's
know,
right.
You might want to find out what happened to me. What's going on?
Yeah. Well, of course, my sister went under hypnosis and found out that during our sighting, well, she and I were both abducted.
Yeah.
She saw me being abducted, and then she was abducted. So I don't recall any of that, and I don't want to. You know?
But, yeah.
But
I
did.
That's often what happens. One person remembers and the other one doesn't.
Right. But I did have either a dream or a memory at that time of walking past these little guys at a long... What I saw was a grill with hamburgers on it.
Oh.
And they were all lined up, and, you know, and I think that was the panel, the control panel for the... craft. And these little small grays were at the control panel. But what what the screen memory was that they had given me was it was a long grill with hamburgers on it.
Okay. What a nice, safe memory.
Yes. And then I was walking up a backless spiral staircase in a round room. Now, my sister has this terrible fear of backless staircases.
Okay.
And why? I don't know. I don't have a fear of them, but I do recall this quote-unquote dream where I am walking up a spiral staircase in a round room.
So that is the way that your mind allows you to remember.
Right.
So you're safe in the thought that this is a dream.
Right.
But now that time has passed, you realize, well, that wasn't really a dream, and she's afraid of the backless staircase because she was there and she experienced it.
Right. And she's not really afraid of cats, but she doesn't like cats. And I had a cat. I'm not afraid of cats, but I can see in a cat's eyes why she might be afraid because of these big eyes, you know.
Could it be, and it's the pupils?
Yeah, the pupils in the eye.
That are sideways compared to ours?
Well, sideways, they're vertical, aren't they?
I mean, I said sideways. I was thinking, yes, vertical, yes.
Vertical. Yeah, but I think the sideways you're thinking of is they're almond-shaped.
Yeah.
They're almond-shaped eyes with vertical vertical pupils.
Yeah, and that is a form of eyes that many people have seen.
Yeah, the big black, big black almond-shaped eyes.
Is yeah,
very common in the abduction genre. You know.
Oh yeah.
So
that explains why that explains the fear of cats.
Yeah, yeah.
Those eyes.
Yeah. And you have written at least one book. How many books have you written?
Well, at least one.
At least one.
Yeah, well, at least the one. I did write the one with Joyce. I've never told anyone but.
Okay.
And Joyce Hagelthorne, and that was a lot of fun to do because she had been a newspaper editor for many, many years of the Dearborn Press. And so I was able to take all of her columns and put them into chapters by subject.
All of her
and
poems?
And that gave... an opportunity then for the reader to go back and read all of the very interesting reports that people had told her over the years, some of which were abduction experiences and some were just ghosts and hauntings and just intriguing paranormal things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember I mentioned Joyce earlier in the program, and Joyce Hagelthorne was really into anything paranormal. I mean,
oh yeah,
beautiful lady. And
she was great.
Yeah, yeah. That was a big loss to.
Yeah, and one of the things Joyce told all of us is that she used to say, "You make your own reality."
Mm.
And she really, really believed in the power of the mind to create reality. In other words, if you would really focus on having good things happen for yourself, good would come your way. But if you were a negative personality, you would draw that negativity towards you.
All right. Right. So you just have to think positive, right?
Even just think positive. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, if life hands you lemons, et cetera, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So those people are, she's gone now. Dr. Levengood is gone. Dr. Getty's gone. I mean, we have lost some really outstanding researchers.
Yes. Well, I consider you an outstanding researcher yourself.
Oh, thank you, Dave. I consider you a researcher, too. And I know myself and all the audience appreciate the fact that you have your program and you bring these things to light and you keep making people aware. This stuff is out there. It's happening. It needs to be researched. It needs to be explored. It needs to be publicized.
It does. It does need to be publicized. And I hope I'm accomplishing that. I always say that, you know, like people say, aren't you worried that the government is going to get you for doing this show? And the government doesn't want me. I'm the finger pointer. Look at what Marilyn knows. Look at what Friedman knows. Look at what this guy knows, you know?
Yeah.
I'm the finger pointer. I just give people a forum to air their evidence. So what do you have planned in the future?
What do I have planned in the future?
Yeah, in this area with your website.
I would like to find a way to get more people connected with each other, somehow using maybe our technology, cell phones, whatever, Twitter. I would like to find a way where when people have a sighting that we can all know about it.
Right.
Because I've heard enough reports where something will happen like in Indiana and then the UFO will be seen coming across the Michigan line. It will go from Michigan to Ohio. It'll travel around the country in the course of one evening. And I think it'd be phenomenal if all of us could somehow be on a network and be out there, be on the watch, be aware.
Right.
And know.
Right.
I would like to see that happen.
Hmm. And could they do that through your website?
I would like, if someone wants to help me figure out the technology, yes, but it needs to be something faster than a website. It needs to be, I think, cell phone technology.
Yeah, yeah.
So that we can text each other or somehow just get the word out, hey, there's something coming across the border. Let's go check. Let's get our cameras. Let's go watch and wait.
Hmm. Yeah, indeed. You should propose that on your website, unless you already have.
No, I haven't done that yet. You just asked a question. It's just something I've been thinking about.
Well, put it on
there.
What's
that, Dave?
Dave Twitchell said, do this.
Yeah.
And here,
exactly.
Here I am. Of course, I'll take all the credit. And
yeah. Well, maybe because we're talking about it, this will give other people the idea.
Yeah, and you do all the work. How's that?
No, okay. Well, I thought I'd need some help on it.
I did my help. I suggested it.
Okay, very good, very good. Well, maybe we'll have some helpers out there in the audience that want to help figure out how we do this.
It sounds good. So, to our listeners, where do they go to contact Marilyn?
They can contact me at the website, abduct.com. They can write to me at the website, abductions@AOL.com. And I'm looking forward to hearing from everybody.
That's great. I appreciate you coming on the show today and discussing Dr. Levengood and discussing your very personal traumas and your website. And, of course, you are, people don't know this, Marilyn is my webmaster for my website. So I thank you for doing that, too.
Thank you, David. I've enjoyed being on your program, and I hope to hear from your listeners, and I'm very excited about all the things we've talked about.
Yes. I hope our listeners do contact Marilyn and go to abduct.com and check out her website. Maybe you've had an experience that you'd like to share, and that would be great. She would love to hear from you. Marilyn, thanks again. You have a good
one. Okay, thank you, Dave.
Bye-bye. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can contact me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. But I want to take this opportunity to wish all of our loyal listeners a very happy holiday season and a Merry Christmas and the best of a new year. 2014. Can you imagine that? Ouch. Anyway, this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.fm's website. Click on Talk Shows on the webpage, on the homepage. Then, a Tuesday forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is UFOImplications.com. So please stay tuned to WHFR.fm, the station making waves for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Mountain Stage, the internationally distributed weekly two-hour live performance program out of West Virginia and hosted by Larry Gross, has made the move to Wednesdays 6 to 8 p.m. Tune in for live folk, blues, bluegrass, and more right here on WHFR.fm, the station making waves. Again, that's Mountain Stage on its new night and time, Wednesdays 6 to 8, here on WHFR.fm.
This is Omni646, and you are listening to 89.3 WHFR Dearborn.
Dig deeper. Local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area on the new WHFR Journal every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. and anytime as a podcast from WHFR.fm. Join our WHFR news team as we dig deeper, making waves.
WHFR, the station making waves, proudly presents The Best of Broadway, a program featuring the best of American musical theater. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Joe, your host. We've taken care of your tickets. Now let me escort you through 2 hours of enjoyment of The Best of Broadway.